How about we get him a real attorney? I mean, what the hell is this? This is who he hires?
What? Are you kidding me? This is the guy you want. This is the guy I'd hire.
Oh, it's the guy you'd hire.
Dudes like Houdini. Seriously, when the going gets tough, you don't want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer. Know what I'm saying?
That's a clip from AMC's Breaking Bad. It was how the world first learned of the amoral lawyer, Saul Goodman, played by Bob Odenkirk. And it wouldn't be the last. Bob has become synonymous with Saul, also known as Jimmy McGill, through the entire run of Breaking Bad and the prequel follow-up, Better Call Saul. Before that, Bob enjoyed a chameleon-esque career. He was a journeyman sketch comedy writer for Second City, Saturday Night Live, and The Ben Stiller Show. He then went on to co-create and co-star in the groundbreaking HBO sketch comedy series, Mr. Show with Bob and David. Bob writes about his incredible career in a memoir called Comedy, 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 Drama. Now, with his feature film Nobody, I'm betting that the paperback version's title will be Comedy, 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 Drama, Action. He joined us via Zoom from his home in Los Angeles to talk about his journey from Mr. Show to Saul Goodman and his lone legacy sketch for Saturday Night Live.
I had been at Second City doing one-man show in the ETC theater thanks to the kindness and generosity of Joyce Sloan, a famous den mother of Second City. And so they knew me there. And of course, all the people that I'd started with, in particular Dave Pasquese and Holly Wartell and Jill Talley, were in the main stage company. So they'd kind of risen up through the ranks, and I had left, gone to Saturday Night Live, then invited back. Chris Farley was invited in, also abruptly, not really going through the program, but he was so funny, so undeniable. And then one night he was improvising, playing a coach, and we were doing an anti-drug improvised speech to a bunch of high schoolers. And that character, the way he moved, the things he talked about, it just stuck in my head. And I went home and that night sat alone and wrote on a legal pad the sketch, the motivational speaker. And I've probably written, you know, a couple thousand sketches in my life. And only a few of them did I write exactly the way they were played.
Now I wonder, Brian, from what I've heard, you're using your paper not for writing, but for rolling doobies. You're gonna be doing a lot of doobie rolling when you're living in a van down by the river.
I will note, when we got to Saturday Night Live, at the end of the sketch, we did not do this at Second City, at the end of the sketch, Robert Smigel said, have him break the table.
Oh, Matt's gonna be your shadow. Here's you, here's Matt. There's you, there. Whoops-a-daisy.
And so I did not write the breaking the table, which was so funny and so such a capper to the sketch. That's Robert Smigel.
You won an Emmy for your work on SNL and on The Ben Stiller Show, but you really came into your own when you joined forces with David Cross to create your HBO sketch comedy series, Mr. Show with Bob and David. What did you want to accomplish with Mr. Show?
Yeah, I kind of felt like I was done with sketch after The Ben Stiller Show. I mean, it feels like it's a young man's game and you have to move on into more storytelling and investment in character. So I was unhappily willing to do that. I did enjoy The Ben Stiller Show a lot, and I had a great deal of freedom there. But that show was very focused on mashing up pop culture things, and I still felt that I wanted to do just a very pure sketch show. And basically, I figured I missed my chance, and that was too bad. But then I met the young, sprightly fellow by the name of David Cross, a troublesome, angry, anarchic, very funny, very smart person who also wanted to make a sketch show with all the same attributes that I was after, kind of mixing in absurdity, moving from one sketch to the other without breaking, without stopping down, and a kind of an angry kind of social commentary, but hopefully interpreted a bit, so it's more than just the news of the week.
That's what this week's show is about!
Yeah, but I'm watching the show right now.
Idiots! It's simple! Look at this! This is what's airing right now, the pet care show! Listen, I'm talking about pets!
Stop calling about racism! We did that a week ago! Look here!
Listen to me for the last time. Crime on the streets happened last week. Everything I'm saying happened last week. Look here! And that concludes our first show, Crime in the Streets. I can't help but think it would have gone a little better had somebody actually called in, but I guess that's because you won't see me until next week. Oh well, as soon as we get the kinks worked out here, I'm sure it's going to be a great, great show.
When it came to comedy, when it came to writing those sketches, we were on the same page. We both were pursuing a degree of excellence in the writing, a clarity in the writing, and kind of a smartness and a surprising quality so that the sketch didn't get dragged down into a repetitive beat. So it was very interesting because we did then, and I think continue to, we're going to start a new project soon, continue to write really well together without one or the other of us doing any one job exclusively. Sometimes David is reining me in. Sometimes he's adding structure. More often, but only slightly, I'm adding structure and I'm trying to clarify his ideas. But we really balance each other out so well and without any real effort to do so.
Well, what do you think is the legacy of Mr. Show with Bob and David?
Well, mostly the legacy is some part of my soul is at peace. It didn't do great in the ratings. It did do great on DVD. Do you know? It was in the top five sellers for like weeks when it first went out on DVD. And the funny thing, the reason I bring it up is because I remember an HBO executive, when we said, can you please put it on video, basically said, why? Nobody's going to buy it. But that was back when people thought nobody's going to buy a TV show on DVD or video. Why would they ever buy it? It's a TV show. And we proved him wrong because he couldn't believe it, this executive, when they finally did make the DVD and it sold really well. The legacy is that a bunch of young people saw it and they were inspired to try sketch comedy and improvisation and writing.
Bro, I never did catch your name.
Saul.
Saul?
Saul Good, man. Get it?
I do. All right, Saul.
In January of 2009, you were working on some projects when you got a call from your agent. He was pitching you this role as a lawyer for a drama called Breaking Bad. What did you see in this character that made you decide to accept the role?
Okay, well, first of all, I was in a financial strain at that point, and I would have said yes to any work because my business manager told me, just say yes to everything. I had a good business manager. He's a good man, and his point was a good one. Just make money, which I needed to do. Okay, leaving that aside, my agent did say, they're going to offer you a role. Do not say no to this one. I think he didn't get the memo that I was in financial strain. He was afraid I was going to say no. Now, listen, I did check into it before I said yes. I called a friend of mine, Reed Harrison. He and I were working on a project at that moment. Not many people had seen Breaking Bad. It was not a success. This was the second season, just starting, actually halfway through shooting. The first season was cut short by a writer's strike. It was only 7 episodes long, and very few people had seen it. I'd seen only the billboards. I called my friend. I said, what do you know about this show, Breaking Bad? And he said, that is the best show on TV. I love it. Oh, my God. You have to do that role. So I was going to say yes. It meant something to me that my friend loved it. I talked to Vince Gilligan. He said, you're a sleazy bus stop bench ad lawyer. And I said, I have an idea for him right away. I have this comb over with a mullet in back. And he goes, great, that'll be great, which is kind of amazing because he's a man of details. And the fact is, I hadn't read the script. I hadn't even seen the show, and I just threw this idea out, and he loved it right away.
I'll tell you one thing, you've got the right product. Anything that gets the DEA's panties in this big a bunch, you're on to something special. And I would like to be a small and silent part of it. Food for thought, yeah? So if you want to make more money and keep the money that you make, better call Saul.
And I only made one or two notes, and I thought, this is a different show. This is a drama. This is an opportunity to act, to not just do a performance that is kind of half me, half comic character, but to really lose myself in a person written by someone else that I don't really know, a different, very different from myself. So I was just about to make another note and, you know, thinking about making the phone call and saying, hey guys, I got some ideas. And I thought, you know what? I don't think a real actor does this. I think a real actor does the script as written. I think they learn the lines. And it occurred to me quickly that because Saul is scripted, speaks so differently from me, it would just make it a more unique person to play if he was literally speaking in cadences and terminology that I would never use. So I didn't write that note. I didn't ask for changes. I learned it pretty much to the comma, and I continued to do that all through Better Call Saul.
A couple of months after Breaking Bad wrapped, the show's creator Vince Gilligan and writer Peter Gould pitched the spinoff Better Call Saul to you. How did you react?
Well, they'd talked about it as a joke over the years. I took it as a joke, only Vince kind of made it sound realistic. He would say, I think there's a story there. I think there's something to say about that guy. And I would always say, well, I don't know. If you think so, then maybe. So here we were at the Chateau Marmont, and they'd asked for this lunch, and it was, I think Breaking Bad was maybe almost a year behind us, but maybe only a few months, 6 months or so. And they said, we think there's a show in Saul. So I said, you know, look, guys, you have to make him likable, because I don't think he's likable outside of the milieu of Breaking Bad.
And here I thought all lawyers were idiots.
Huh, no, only half of us are idiots. The other half are crooks.
Aren't you a spicy one?
Well,
if I were 40 years younger, I'd have you buy me a piña colada.
Well, if you want me to draw up a DNR, I'll bring a blender and some pineapple.
I knew I'd like you when I saw how you saved that poor man on the television.
Well,
Moxie is in such short supply these days.
Yeah, well, I pride myself on my Moxie. I said, if you're going to write about him, here's one thing I think I know about the character. I think he's really likable if he's in a lot of trouble. Physical trouble is great with Saul. If he's hurt physically in his escapades, he becomes particularly likable, and there's some insight into him in those moments, I feel. He's disarmed in a way, and it's a good thing because I feel like the audience sees that guy for the stumbling human that he is in those moments when he's genuinely stumbling. And so I said, I hope if you do write this show, you'll write a lot of that. And they did.
Yeah.
I wish I could tell you about the final season because that note that I just told you, they carry it through the whole final season.
We'll look forward to it then. What is different about the way you played Jimmy McGill versus the way you portrayed Saul Goodman?
Well, what I love about playing the Jimmy Saul Gene Takovic, that's when he's in hiding in the Cinnabon, is I do think we all have some version of that. You know, we have some version of the public persona. Maybe we're a little more strong-willed. We throw our opinion around a little louder. Then there's the family version of ourselves where we're talking to our spouse and maybe our kids. And then there's the version where you're alone, and we see that somewhat too in Better Call Saul. And when you're alone, you're yet another version of yourself. Maybe that's the place where you most are vulnerable and let out feel your self-doubt. And so I get to play all those things in Better Call Saul. I'm extremely lucky.
And you play them, well, they're extremely lucky that they went ahead and did it because you do it so well. You recently made an action movie called Nobody, and this is quite a pivot for you. Why did you want to make an action film?
Well, probably because you asked me that question, and I am tickled by the idea that I did it and pulled it off. And I'm tickled by, it's so crazy. It's so crazy that I would do an unironic, vengeance-filled, anger-filled action movie.
Come on, you gotta give me something.
I will, but not now. I need to take care of this.
What is this?
It is what it is. This is me. Becca, I love you, but I need you to trust me right now. Okay, blind for the last time. I promise.
There are so many reasons why I approached that project, which was written for me based on my own inspiration of inspired by life events where my family was experienced a break-in that was very traumatic for us. And I was left with a lot of feelings of anger that didn't go away very readily or really for a long time. And I thought I could use those feelings to power this performance. I also thought on Saul, I got to play this non-ironic, earnest, intense feeling. And I found it rewarding to go there. It's the most rewarding thing about acting, drama acting, to me. And I thought we could dig into that stuff and use it. And I thought I could get in shape, because I'd have to do the stunts. And that would be an interesting and good thing for a 54-year-old. When I started it, I shot it at 57. It was a real challenge in so many ways. And I wanted that challenge. And I also thought it would never get made.
You've been a comedy writer, a comedic actor, a dramatic actor, an action hero. What's next for Bob Odenkirk?
I got to go to sleep for a couple of years. Rip Van Winkle time.
Yeah. But possibly maybe Nobody 2, right? A sequel?
Yeah, and also, we're trying to make it happen. And we're trying to achieve something of the same vibe of the first film, where you really feel and know, you feel like you know the family and you know the tensions within the family. And then once it starts going, it becomes a fantasy.
Bob Odenkirk, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on comedy, drama. And I'm so pleased for you that everything's coming up Odenkirk, and I hope that continues.
Thanks so much.
Bob Odenkirk is the author of Comedy, Drama. You can find out more about Bob and his incredible career at WPR.org/beta.
I was trying to point out or make fun of the people who profit without scientific reason, but no, that was a thing that I did change because I didn't want people to think this was a political point that I was making.
Coming up, Dana Schwartz joins us to talk about her historical novel, Anatomy, a Love Story. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.